My name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website. And I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 73. I'm recording it on Saturday, January 10th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this podcast is, It's Not a Conspiracy, It's Cognitive Dissonance. The point of this podcast is to address what I think may be the hardest hurdle that people have in making the transition from passive investing to rational investing, the model that I urge, the model that I recommend at the website. John Walter Russell and I are partners in the development of the calculators at our websites. John's site, which you certainly should read, it has all the research that supports the ideas discussed at my site and in these podcasts. John's site is early-retirement-planning-insights.com. John and I often talk amongst ourselves, sometimes publicly, sometimes through emails, about the difficulty, the strange difficulty of getting people to make a shift from the passive investing model, which says you don't need to change your stock allocation when prices go to insanely dangerous levels, and the rational investing model, which says just the opposite. You must change your stock allocation when prices go to insanely dangerous levels if you hope to be a successful long-term investor. The strange thing, we've been at this for close to 7 years. We've both done a lot of work. We work this 7 days a week, and we've been doing so for close to 7 years, both of us. And of course, we've worked with hundreds of other community members who have made constructive contributions, but I don't think any has put in anywhere near the amount of time that John and I have. And so there's a puzzle. And if you understand passive investing, the flaws in it are not at all hard to understand. Intellectually, it's a piece of cake. Just passive investing doesn't make any sense. Every asset that we buy in our lifetimes, price matters. When you buy a car or a house or a comic book or a banana, you look at the price. But when it comes to buying stocks, most of us don't. Most of us have been told for 30 years, don't pay any attention to price. Stocks are always best for the long run. Don't look at price. Don't time the market. If you look at price and you change your stock allocation because stocks are overpriced, that's timing the market. Bad. Bad boy. Bad girl. Don't do that. This is obviously an insane approach to investing. Is that not so? People have a hard time sometimes taking me. Oh, rot! You know, I just had this at the Goon Central board. I've been having some. I'm there. I post there almost every day. And Schroeder's been saying, Rob, you say at this board that passive investing is the biggest get rich quick scheme in history. Well, Rob, you publish this correspondent with Michael Kitsis, a financial planner. If you told Michael that you believed that, he would think you were insane. Well, I went into a discussion about it, but Michael Kitsis knows what I believe. I've made quite clear what I believe in my emails to him. Michael does not agree with everything I say. He agrees with some things I say. But Michael accepts that. Michael's okay with it. And what I said to Schroeder is, Michael is showing us the way out of this mess. Michael doesn't agree with Rob Bennett, but Michael, he knows how to deal with a human being with whom he agrees on some things and disagrees on other things in a civil, respectful, friendly, warm manner. That's the answer. That's what we all need to learn how to do. But the question, the point that Schroeder was making is not an insignificant one. There's something there. He's saying, Rob, your views are so strong that, you're not just saying there might be some circumstances where passive investing might not work out perfectly. You're saying it's a Ponzi scheme, a get-rich-quick, plan. When you really get worked up, you say passive investing is insane. You call your model rational investing, and you contrast it to passive investing, which obviously suggests that passive investing is irrational. Rob, you're insulting people. You're being extreme. That's not. I'm not sure how to respond. I think those comments are comments that should be put on the table. I think a lot of people react that way. I think the goons, the people who engage in highly abusive posting, they respond inappropriately. But many, many people who are my audience, people I want to be talking to, middle-class investors, who are not goons, find that off-putting that I state things so strongly. I'm quite confident that that's the case. I pick these things up. I'm quite clear that it's quite clear that that's the case. And that's probably true of some of the experts that I probably it is true to some extent with Michael. I don't think it's true to the extent Schroeder says, but I do think Michael probably has had those thoughts go through his head that I state things too strongly. I think that was true of Felix Salmon. Felix Salmon wrote a great review of the stock return predictor on his blog. But, we had some correspondence, and I had the feeling Felix liked the calculator, but he felt maybe that I was too strong in what I was saying. I think Scott Burns very much had that feeling. And that's the reason why he said, Rob, your approach, he says you've added a new layer of understanding to the safe withdrawal rate issue, but your approach is catastrophically unproductive. So this is a real thing. Now, why am I so strong? I am strong because this is what I believe. And I think all of our problems stem from the fact that we don't all say what we believe. I have no problem with people advocating passive investing, as long as it's sincere, as long as it does not come with abusive posting, as long as the people who don't endorse passive investing get to have their say and state things as strongly as they believe, human beings will figure this stuff out. I'm not worried about it. So it's important to state things as it's important that all of us state things as strongly as we believe them. And I am a strong opponent of passive investing. I like to think I am the most severe critic of this investing model of anyone alive today. So a question comes up, and it's lurking in the background in all the discussions I've had for close to 7 years now. If passive investing is as bad as I say it is, if the old school safe withdrawal rate studies are going to cause millions of busted retirements, how is it that there are so many smart and good people who advocate passive investing or who promote the old school safe withdrawal rate studies. How can that be? It's an obvious contradiction in what I say. And you know, it's a real thing. As I say, Schroeder is pointing to a real thing. The problem with goon thinking is it's black and white thinking. So what the goons will say is, oh, Rob, is it a conspiracy? Is it a conspiracy? And there is a temptation at times, quite frankly, to believe it is a conspiracy. I won't say that the thought hasn't crossed my mind. I don't think I'm prone to conspiracy theories, but when you see some of the things I have seen, you start to wonder. It does at times look like a conspiracy. But ultimately, I don't believe that that's the case. So I have to come up with an alternate theory. What's the alternate theory? The alternate theory is something called cognitive dissonance. This is a concept from the psychology literature. It's obviously the sort of thing that someone who believes in behavioral finance would look at. And I believe this is the explanation for why there are many smart people who believe in passive investing and many good people who believe in passive investing. And the interesting thing about cognitive dissonance, it comes from the, you know, from the psychological literature on psychology, human psychology. It really is a concept that goes directly at odds with the efficient market theory. The efficient market theory is the intellectual framework for the passive investing model. All the investing, not 90% of the investing advice you've heard over the past 30 years is influenced by the efficient market theory. And the efficient market theory is directly at odds with the cognitive dissonance concept. The efficient market theory says that investors are rational. Therefore, all investors are trying to maximize returns and diminish risk. It's an assumption. It's not something that was ever proven. It's an assumption. And all of the investing advice you have heard for 30 years is built on top of that assumption. If the assumption's wrong, all of the investing advice is wrong. The idea that investors are trying to maximize their return and diminish their risk is obviously not, at least not on the surface, it's not a crazy idea. It's very plausible. It sounds like that's just what you would think, isn't it? You would think, yeah, why wouldn't they want to maximize return? And this is the sort of thing that John and I wonder about it, marvel at it times. We've come up with calculators that can help people to invest far more effectively than they have ever invested before at far less risk. And we tell people about it, and a good number of those people threaten to kill us or to ban us from their discussion boards. Why would anyone behave in such a way? It truly is something to marvel at. Well, the answer is, I believe, that while the efficient market theory on first glance sounds plausible, sounds reasonable, it's missing something. What it's missing is that the stocks are owned by humans, and humans ain't 100% rational. They just ain't. They just aren't. I'm sorry. They just aren't. Humans are not 100% rational. We are partly rational, just rational enough to make the efficient market theory sound plausible, but not rational enough to make it work in the real world, or to make the investing advice that follows from it work in the real world. Cognitive dissonance, the beauty of it is that it explains why human behavior is not only not 100% rational, it is often anti-rational. We are, what's the word? Perverse. Human behavior is often perverse. And that's what we've seen in the great safe withdrawal rate debate. We haven't seen people that have gotten it a little bit wrong. We've seen people that have gotten it totally wrong and are adamant about not admitting it, even though they themselves suffer the consequences of being wrong. Everyone's looking, you know, people are looking at things like the Bernie Madoff matter. You know, he had this hedge fund and people were ripped off, and they're looking at it and saying, oh, he's a bad guy. We've got to find all the bad guys. We've got to hang them up from a tree. He may be a bad guy. There's clearly evidence that that's so. I haven't studied it enough to say, but there's clearly evidence. But what matters in the Bernie Madoff matter is not, was he a bad guy or not? What matters is, why did people fall for it? And people fell for it for exactly the same reason that people fall for passive investing. People are trying to destroy themselves. It's not that these people like Bernie Madoff are such great tricksters. That's not what's going on. There was a fellow, I don't know his name, but there was a fellow who wrote this long 17-page letter memo about why Madoff's fund was obviously a Ponzi scheme. Showing it by the mathematics. And he sent it to the SEC, and the SEC investigated. And they gave him a bill of health. They said Bernie Madoff is fine. The SEC's not in on the conspiracy, for heaven's sake. They're humans. That's the problem. It's a conspiracy of humans. And the same thing's true with the S&P and this idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation when prices get to insane levels. There's a human conspiracy there too. Cognitive dissonance makes us behave in perverse ways, not ways that are a little bit wrong. And so I want to discuss it a little bit. And I'm going to be working from a website where I found some material on cognitive dissonance, and I'll try to give the address here. It's a little hard to read web addresses, but on a podcast, it's easier to just put them forward in a print article. But it's www.ocf.berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y .edu for educational, .edu/ Oh, and then it's one of those wavy lines. I forget what they call them. One of those wavy lines. www.psychology/persuasion.shtml. And this is an article at a website that deals with cognitive dissonance. And it mentions five cognitive dissonance tactics. The Ben Franklin effect, hazing, counter-attitudinal advocacy, labeling, and foot-in-the-door technique. So I want to go over those just to give you an idea of what cognitive dissonance is all about, so you'll be able to make sense of why it is that the investing advice you've heard for the past 30 years is so horribly wrong. Not a little bit wrong, but directly contrary to what works in the real world. When you've been told timing doesn't work, you've been told the exact opposite of the reality. Timing is required for effective stock investing. When you've been told stocks are always best for the long run, you've been told directly the opposite of what the reality is. Stocks are obviously sometimes the best asset class, at other times they're absolutely the worst place to put your money. Dangerous as all get out. The Ben Franklin effect. The guy here at the website describes this. It's an experience that Ben Franklin had. He was trying to persuade an enemy, I don't know, somebody who opposed him. I think this was in the Congress or something. And he's trying to persuade him to his side on some political issue. And he says, how am I going to do this? How am I going to persuade this guy? And what he did was, he found out that the guy had a great book collection. And he wrote the guy a note, a polite note, saying, oh, you know, I'd really like to borrow this particular book that you have, and, you know, it'd be a great favor if you would do that. And the guy presumably felt, you know, even though he wasn't a Ben Franklin fan, he said, well, you know, I can lend the guy a book. It wouldn't kill me to lend him a book. So he lent him the book. After he lent him the book, it became harder for him to oppose Franklin. And this is counterintuitive. This is the sort of thing that the people who came up with the efficient market theory would, it would blow their little minds. But Ben Franklin was counting on this cognitive dissonance. I doubt that he knew the word cognitive dissonance. But he was counting on this to win this guy over. It was a strategy. Why would lending someone a book cause you to like them if you didn't like them before? It should be the opposite, right? If it should be the guy who was able to borrow the book who would like the guy. You know, the guy did a favor for Ben Franklin, and by doing a favor for him, it overcame his opposition to him. You know, huh? The reason it works is that the guy, cognitive dissonance is all about discomfort and the desire, the human desire for relief from discomfort. The guy couldn't turn him down when he asked to borrow a book. You know, what are you going to say? I'm not going to lend you my book. You know, he would have felt like a small person. He might oppose him on the legislation question, but he's not going to oppose him on lending a book. So Ben Franklin got him to do something for him, do something for Franklin. Now, once he did something for Franklin, his mind started to play tricks on him. He started to say, wait, there's a contradiction here. See, cognitive dissonance is all about contradictions, internal contradictions. And he said, there's a contradiction here. I don't like this Franklin fellow, but I don't like his politics, but I just lent him a book. I'm sort of being friendly with him. That doesn't add up. I'm being friendly with a guy I don't like. I don't like his, you know. And he had to resolve that. This is how humans are. We must resolve our conflicts, or else they cause us great discomfort. So how do you resolve it? You could have said, give me that book back. I'm not giving books to people who don't agree with me on politics. He could have resolved it that way. He probably would have felt like a creep. So he didn't. He resolved it by saying, internally, he didn't express this in words. Internally, he started thinking, well, maybe that Ben Franklin guy's not so bad after all. Maybe I lent the guy a book. He can't be that bad. I mean, I'm smart, and I lent him a book, so I must not dislike him too much. Maybe he's got some good points. Maybe I should listen. Maybe I should hear him out. Ben Franklin won this guy over by asking the guy to lend him a book. I tried to do something like this when I was at the Vanguard Diehards. I remember Mel Lindauer, you know, was bashing me, and I said, you know, he says, oh, you know, you're this, you're that, you're the other thing. I said, Mel, look, I said, I've got, you know, 2,000 posts put to this board. Is there one post that you think had some value? I did that because I said, if I can get Mel to agree that there's one thing about Rob Bennett he ever could stand, we might see change. But he couldn't do it. I do this when I talk about, you know, I'll talk about some of the goons. Some of the goons are friends of mine from days before the Great Debate. And sometimes I'll say that. I'll say, oh, you know, Arendt, my old friend, or, you know, Schroeder, my old friend. Oh, and they get livid. Don't call me your friend. I'm not your friend. You told the truth about safe withdrawal rates. I'm not your friend. They can't admit that they're my friend, because if they do, cognitive dissonance will kick in. And once somebody's your friend, you can't say, I'm going to kill him. I mean, I'm going to go to his house and kill his wife and kids. Cognitive dissonance would prevent that. But they, you know, they've got to say they're going to come to my house and kill my wife and kids, because otherwise I'm going to tell the truth about safe withdrawal rates. And you know, how are they gonna get me banned from these boards if they don't disrupt the threads with death threats and all this sort of thing? The point here is humans do not humans are not rational. We are partly rational. To a large extent, we are anti-rational. We are perverse. And Ben Franklin took advantage of this in this phenomenon that is referred to at this website as the Ben Franklin effect. You know, a lot of us, we come to believe things about stocks because we're trying to resolve contradictions. You know, we start out, most middle-class people started out thinking high-priced stocks are dangerous. Many, many people believe that on some deep level. But what happens in the 1980s and 1990s when you have a belief that high-priced stocks are dangerous and yet you start to hear stories in the paper or you start to hear stories from your friends of people making money invested in high-priced stocks? You've got a conflict. You don't believe in it yourself, but you see that your friends are making money. That causes discomfort. That causes people to say, I don't want to believe this anymore. I want to believe something different. And if there's a theory that's endorsed by experts, holy moly, experts, that says, hey, nothing wrong with high-priced stocks. Price doesn't matter with stocks. Stocks for the long run. Timing doesn't work. Now you resolve the conflict. Now you can invest in high-priced stocks and feel fine about it. That's where this is coming from. It's not because, and it's not that the experts are necessarily trying to trick you either. The experts, you know, cognitive dissonance works on experts too. We're all in this together. We're all fooling each other. A second phenomenon of cognitive existence is hazing. Hazing. We all know about hazing. You know, you have to go through hazing to get in college fraternities. There's hazing rituals. You know, when you join the Marines, you know, there's hazing of you know, med students, you know, they're put through these horrible routines when they're, you know, when they're finishing their schooling, where they work, you know, 20-hour days, you know, for weeks at a time. That's a form of hazing. You know, they're not allowed into the profession until they've survived the hazing. Well, what's that about? Why would hazing, you know, why would you... This is strange. It's a strange phenomenon. And the way the guy describes hazing at the site is get people to like the situation by making them suffer to get there. Think a little bit about dating. What's the worst thing you can do? What's the worst thing you can do? Worst thing you can do is to appear needy, you know. Oh, go out with me, you know. Go out with me and I'll be so grateful. I'll treat you just great. Well, that's a turnoff. Play a little hard to get. Then but not so hard that the person doesn't have a chance. And then the person becomes infatuated because they earned it. They earned it. That's you know, a very low-level form of hazing. Get people to like the situation by making them suffer to get there. We suffer. Stock investors suffer in all sorts of ways. Buying into the conventional advice. Your one way in which we all suffer is that we give up the use of human reason. I make this point all the time. I say, once you become a passive investor, you've given up the use of human reason because the idea that price doesn't matter when it comes to stocks is insane. It's not, it's transparently insane. This was another question came up at the Goon Central Board Drip Guy this morning, was saying, oh, Rob, how is it that you're the first person in the history of the planet that ever came to understand this? Well, obviously, that's not so. But we all recognize that prices affect long-term returns. It's so painfully obvious. It's the fact that it's so painfully obvious is what makes it so taboo to say it. If it were some complicated formula I came up with, E equals MC squared, there would be no controversy. Everyone would say, fine, Rob, you're a genius. Thanks for helping us out. But what I did was I told people something they all knew to begin with from the very first day, and people obviously knew it long before I ever came on the scene. And that hurts. To have somebody come along and point out these retirement studies are going to cause millions of busted retirements, everybody knew that. They didn't say it. It was taboo. Rob Bennett was the first one to say that those studies should be corrected. I put out a press release saying these studies need to be corrected before people suffer millions of busted retirements. But everybody knew it. They just couldn't say it. They couldn't say it because they were invested. They were over-invested in stocks. And it would be a conflict to come out and say, oh, we're over-invested in stocks, but stocks are dangerous. You can't admit halfway through the game that you made a mistake. So we suffer hazing, we suffer a form of hazing when we give up the use of human reason. When we first buy into the passive investing model, or the whatever it happens to be called at the particular time. This model's been with us since the first stock market opened for business. It goes by different names. It's emotional investing. Whenever you say prices don't matter, you are investing emotionally, pure emotion. And that is, it's a low-level form of hazing. You are giving up the use of human reason. You are degrading yourself, giving up your reason. Another example is when people started to lose money. People didn't just lose money in the price crash of the last year. People were been losing money since January of 2000. I point out that if you looked at the historical data in January of 2000, you knew the most likely 10-year return at that time was a negative number. Why would any sane person put a large amount of their retirement money in an asset class likely to provide a negative real return for 10 years running? Why? Because they had to suffer to get there. And they don't want to give it up. That's counterintuitive. It's the opposite of rationality. It's perverse. But it's very, very human. It's called cognitive dissonance. And of course, starting in 2000, the suffering wasn't just giving up the use of human reason. It was an actual financial suffering. And so now, people who have suffered for 8 years are saying, "I can't quit now. I've look at all the money I've lost. I can't give up on passive investing now. I admit that I was wrong now." No, they'd rather suffer more. Bring on the suffering. Make it crushing. That's how humans work. And there's a lot of literature showing this. A third cognitive dissonance phenomenon is counter-attitudinal advocacy. From this one, I think I should read the example that the guy gives at the website, because It's quite compelling. He's talking about people who are in cults, and many people have referred to the Vanguard Diehards board as a cult, and the Bogleheads.org board as a cult. And I think there's some truth to that. The one sense in which I resist that is that I think the whole thing is a cult. I think it, investing is just filled with cultishness, and so I don't entirely like screening out or focusing in on those particular boards and saying those are the only cults, but they are certainly cult-like, and they're an intense cult. The dogmatic passive investors are an intense cult, intensely cult-like. But it goes on everywhere. It goes on with all investing philosophies. In one experiment, I'm reading here from the website, three psychology graduate students join a doomsday cult with the hidden intent of simply observing what goes on so they can publish a paper on it later. This cult had a charismatic leader, a Ms. Kitsch, who apparently was telepathically tuned to the planet Clarion. The world was going to end soon on a particular date. A flying saucer would pick up the cult members at a particular location. Ms. Kitsch included many details that seemed to make her prophecy more convincing, such as saying that all pieces of metal would have to be removed during the pickup. Perhaps the metal would disrupt the tractor beam. The students watch cult members give up everything, relinquishing their jobs and families, selling all possessions. On doomsday, the cult members are standing in the middle of nowhere, staring quietly up at the sky, watching with bated breath. The anticipation in the air is so thick you could pick it up and eat it with chopsticks. The critical moment comes. The critical moment passes. Hey, we're still alive. The graduate students look around and look at each other, an awkward silence. What happens now? Ms. Kitsch then says that she's receiving another message from the aliens and will be back shortly. After a brief leave, Ms. Kitsch returns and says, "We have saved the world." How did the cult members respond to this contradiction? You might think they became really angry, having discarded their entire lives for an event that didn't happen. However, what actually happened is that belief in the cult became stronger than ever. The cult members were even more convinced of the cult's validity. It is worth noting that the cult body tended to consist of rational and intelligent people, often skilled in computers and web design. When an idea that we believe in fails, we often do not give up the idea. We cling to it more tenaciously than ever. That's humans. That's humans for you. That's cognitive dissonance. That ain't the efficient market theory. But that's the real world. That's how humans react. Now, we're seeing this going on in among passive investing dogmatists today. They're, you know, people are at the bogleheads.org board. They're noting that, you know, one of the leaders, Taylor Larimore, is saying, "Hey, I have a plan B." He's never mentioned plan B for 10 years. Never mentioned it in his book. Was asked directly if he ever would consider selling stocks. He said, "Absolutely not." But now that prices have crashed, he's saying, "Oh, I have a plan B. And plan B is I'm going to go to a zero stock allocation. No stocks at all. Sell after a crash. That's plan B." And there's another guy, Adrian Nenu. His plan B is, he says, he's always said, "I don't believe in timing the market. Stick with the same stock allocation." He's now suffered devastating losses as a result of doing so. His answer is to go to 100% stock allocation. He's trying to make it up. Instead of getting scared and bailing out, he's trying to make it up. Neither of these solutions have anything to do with passive investing principles. But both of these people are considered passive investing dogmatists in fine standing. What's happening is the cult is changing. You know, it's just like this woman that said, you know, the end of the world is coming. And when it didn't come, she said, "Hey, the world didn't end. But we all know that we communicate with these aliens. Well, let's go check what the aliens say." Oh, you know, because we believed it saved the world. The world didn't have to blow up anymore. They just came up with an alternate explanation, totally contrary to everything they had believed before. But they'd rather believe something crazy than give up, than experience this conflict of thinking they had wasted their lives, they'd given up their families for some idiot, you know, idea that the world was going to come to an end on a certain date. The same thing's true with passive investors. What passive investors do after they suffer bone-crushing losses, and they always do, is they develop an intense hatred of stocks. Passive investing has two sides. Wild overinvestment in stocks at times of high prices, and then a hatred of stocks that leads them to never put a penny in stocks for decades after prices return to reasonable levels, after stocks are again providing good long-term returns. Passive investors always do the wrong thing, but they are consistent. They're emotionally consistent. The answer, of course, is to break the cycle, to get the message out that this is not the way to go. But to do that, we're not going to do it just with rational argument. We're going to have to come to a better understanding of how humans work and how that influences stock prices. And then we have to educate people. We have to use some of the same tricks that have been used to persuade us to invest passively. We have to use those same tricks to persuade us to invest rationally. We need to flip it. Instead of having a marketing slogan that tells people, you know, 1,000 times, timing doesn't work, timing doesn't work, timing doesn't work, we have to say, timing is required, timing is required, timing is required. And people will get it. But it won't happen overnight, and it won't happen without some sophisticated thinking about what's required. Now, when I mentioned this phenomenon of counter-attitudinal advocacy, one of the things that should be, you know, hitting you is this applies, you know, the rule here, the guy says at the website, when we state opinions we don't believe, we start to believe them. See, these cult members didn't believe in this stuff, you know, in the beginning. But they started to say it, and the more they said it, the more they believed it. And after the world didn't come to an end, they believed it more than ever. Because they had so much at risk psychologically. They had such psychological pain they were going to experience if they acknowledged reality at this late date. Well, think about the experts. Who has more to lose by telling the truth about stock investing? The average investor who will lose his retirement? Or the expert who gets paid maybe millions of dollars a year to give this advice and who has been giving it for 30 years and has caused human suffering on a level that can't be calculated? If you've, you know, for the people who have given the old school safe withdrawal rate studies to people looking to plan their retirements, these people have caused millions of busted retirements. Millions. Presuming that stocks perform in the future somewhat as they've always performed in the past. That's not easy to accept. So what happens is the experts believe more than ever. The more harm they cause, the more they believe. Not because they're bad, not because they're evil, not because they're dumb, not because they're in a conspiracy, because they're human. And this is how humans act. So we have to learn. The people listening to the experts have to learn that you can't just trust an expert because they went to school or because they read a lot of books or because they manage a big fund or because they're nice people or because they're smart. If what an expert tells you doesn't make sense, you have to check it out. You have to hang on to your common sense. Labeling. The fourth phenomenon, get people to act in a certain way by talking to them as if they already were that way. I do this with my kids to some extent. You know, they gave an example here where they talked about getting fifth graders to pick up trash. And, you know, they ran an experiment where they took these fifth graders and, you know, they had a control and they just, you know, told them, you know, look, you're going to get punished. You don't pick up the paper, you know, your papers you throw on the ground, you're going to get punished. And the fifth graders blow them off. If anything, they get a little rebellious and they throw a couple more extra, you know, papers on the ground. But if they start telling them, you know, they come in and they say, this is the class I've been hearing about, the one that's the neat class. I've been hearing that you always pick up your papers, you put things away properly. That's great. Then they start doing it. How to trick fifth graders into cleaning up their rooms. That works. people don't like. They don't like to feel uncomfortable. And when people are saying, "Oh, you're so neat, you're so well behaved," they say, "Oh, I don't really think I am, but it's making me feel a little funny. Maybe I better start acting that way." They want to resolve the conflict. This is an important force in human nature. Foot in the door technology. They ran some experiments where they came up with these idiotic requests. They would go to the homes of people and say, "We want you to put a big sign on your front lawn saying 'Drive safe.'" And most people say, "You know, that's idiotic. I'm not going to do that." But if they go to them first and they say, they ask a very small request. They say, "Would you be willing to sign a petition? People be taught to drive safe." I'll say, "Well, yeah, that sounds reasonable. It wouldn't hurt to sign a petition." They sign the petition. Then they say, "Okay, thank you for signing our petition. Would you be willing to put a sign on your lawn, a giant sign that says 'Drive safe'?" I say, "Well, I signed a petition, I guess. I'm in favor of safe driving, you know. I did sign that petition. I suppose that wouldn't be such a bad thing. I guess I could do that." If you ask something small first, you get your foot in the door. This, of course, every salesman knows this, right? The salesman trying to get you to buy a car gets you to say the word yes 15 times in succession before he lets you see the price of the car. "Do you like a track? You look like the kind of fellow who knows his cars. Am I right? Yes. Yeah. Oh, I knew that. I knew that as soon as you came in. You look like a successful sort of individual. You look like the sort of you're the kind of guy who's, not gonna fall for any old car. You're gonna want a good car. Am I right?" "Well, yes. Well, I knew it. You get people to say yes to little things. And then when you spring the big thing on them, there's cognitive dissonance. "I can't say no. I've been saying yes to this fellow. Can't, if I say no, it's sort of like there's conflict. With all those yeses, I got to say yes. Feeling discomfort. Got to get rid of that discomfort." Make lots of small requests. Well, people didn't, in January of 2000, the long-term return on stocks was a negative number. But if the experts had come along in January of 2000 and started pitching stocks and said, "Hey, we've come to the conclusion you should be investing a lot of money in stocks," and they hadn't done it years before, nobody would have gone along with that. People would have said, "Are you nuts? I'm going to invest in an asset class with a likely negative return for 10 years? I'm going to put my retirement money in that? Are you off your rocker?" But they didn't do it that way. They started telling people to invest heavily in stocks and that prices didn't matter, in the late 1980s and throughout all the 90s. They started with little things. They said, "Would you invest a lot in stocks if the PE10 level was 8, which is what it was in 82? They say, "Well, seems reasonable. Low price, it's half a fair value. It seems like a prudent decision. I won't invest. Well, I might invest 40% of my money. I need to be careful. The stocks are very dangerous, you know." "Oh, yes, we know." The experts say, "Well, yes, of course, dangerous, but 40%, that's prudent." "Yeah, I agree. That is prudent." But they up it. It starts with 40% at a PE10 of 8. Then it's 60% at a PE10 of 20. Then it's 80% at a PE10 of 40. The more dangerous stocks get, the more pressure we experience to invest heavily in them. This has been going on since the first stock market opened for business. That's, of course, the reason why the P10 level gets to 44. But the point is, this isn't part of a conspiracy. It's not like these experts are getting together in a room and saying, you know, how can we screw the middle class? They're selling us what we want to be sold. And in 82, we wanted to be sold a little bit. And they got the foot in the door with these crazy ideas that valuations don't matter. And as time went on, we became open to more and more crazy things until we reached a point where we were willing to put large amounts of money in stocks when they were insanely dangerous. But that's how humans operate. If you develop your investing advice by looking at the efficient market theory, this would never occur to you in a million years. But if you look at things like the psychological literature, behavioral finance, it all fits. I mean, it I'm tempted to say it makes sense. It makes sense in a crazy sort of way, but it does make sense in a crazy sort of way. Stock investing, cognitive dissonance applies in all sorts of areas of life endeavor, but stock investing was made for it. Because stock investing is an area where we all have to do it. You really have no choice. If you want to retire, you've got to put money in stocks. So we have no choice. We all are intimidated by stocks. Most of us don't really want to study the matter that much. So we're going into it with little knowledge. The type of knowledge that we believe is needed is numbers oriented, which most of us are intimidated by. The experts, of course, talk numbers, you know, like they were born with it, like they were born with calculators in their hands. So we naturally defer to them. And the killer is stock investing is cyclical. There are long time periods when high stock allocations work, and then there are long time periods when low stock allocations work. And the one follows the other. So we get 20 years to learn these lessons. Timing doesn't work. Stocks for the long run, buy and hold. And then the lesson, the opposite, becomes the truth. What was true during the insane bull market is the opposite of the truth during the insane bear market that inevitably follows. See, what we need to do is to stop bull markets and thereby stop bear markets. Then the problem goes away. But in order to do that, we need some self-reflection. We need to understand that ignoring the only clue as to when this is going to happen is the valuation level. That's the only way you can know when stock investing is going to become dangerous. And guess what the efficient market theory says to ignore as its first principle? Price. Valuations. Under the efficient market theory, the real truth is that valuations don't even make any sense, because in the efficient market theory, stocks are always properly priced. There's no such thing as overvaluation under the efficient market theory. It's all a big joke. Even passive investors don't say that there's no such thing. But if they were logically consistent, they would acknowledge that. If the market were efficient, it would be properly priced. That's what it means. That's what the word efficient means. Properly priced. If the market were properly priced, we never would have been at a P10 level of 44. So the very fact that we were there disproved the efficient market theory. But we tune that out. Because you see, that presents a conflict. If you start thinking about it, wait a minute, I thought the price didn't matter. I thought, same stock allocation, but look, P1044, that doesn't fit. Well, that causes discomfort. Looking at a fact like that causes discomfort. And cognitive dissonance tells us that humans don't like such discomfort. So they ignore it, or they change their behavior so that the discomfort goes away, but they change their behavior in very self-destructive ways in order to make that discomfort go away. That's the phenomenon. One of the things I thought when I put up my post, May 13th, 2002, that the safe withdrawal rate studies were wrong, I was worried. I knew that, John Graney had a goon squad. I'm not that stupid. But I thought, look, it's a mathematical calculation. How can I lose? The guy can't get away with, giving the wrong number that people use to plan their retirements. But he did. He's gotten away with it for 7 years. And he ain't the only one by a long stretch. People actually are angry at me for reporting the safe withdrawal rate accurately and praise the guy who got it wrong. They think that's just great because he relieved their cognitive dissonance. And I set off a firestorm. I gave them something they couldn't ignore, a number. They could ignore me if I would just say it's my opinion, but I don't say that. I say this is what the historical data says. And, that's what you can't do. But it's what we need to do if we want to grow up as investors. The most painful realities are the most obvious realities. All realities can cause cognitive dissonance for people who are not living in reality, and none of us live in reality to a complete sense. But the most painful realities are the most obvious. So the things that we're going to see, if passive investing was, if there was some trickiness about it, if I could just come up with some complicated explanation of why it doesn't work, people might buy into that. But there is no complicated explanation. It's just as obvious could be. It doesn't work because it's stupid. The idea of not changing your stock allocation when prices change is stupid. Right? Somebody told you, don't look at the price of the car you buy. You'd say, that is the dumbest piece of advice I've ever heard. But you've heard it about stocks thousands of times, and people say, oh, very interesting. How did you become such an expert? You studied many years, academic research. Very good. Another reason why stock investing is so prone to the cognitive dissonance phenomenon is that it's scary. And cognitive dissonance is a way of dealing with things that are scary, a coping mechanism. And putting your money on the line, putting your life savings on the line is a scary thing when you don't, especially in stocks where the values change all the time. It's a scary thing. So the way we should deal with the fact that it's scary is we should be open to all sorts of points of view so that we can protect ourselves, so that we can learn and be as informed as we possibly can be. But the human way to deal with it is just the opposite. The human way is to say, I'm scared, so I'll put all my chips on one idea, and I'll never question that idea, and then I'll never be scared again, because I'll never have to think about any other possibilities. That's crazy, but it's very human. I always think about this time when I was, as a boy, and I fell, and I got some dirt, I think, in the cut, on my knee. And it got infected. And I didn't want to tell my parents. It started to hurt. And I didn't want to tell my parents because I knew something was wrong. I said, they're going to make me go to the doctor. I don't go to the doctor. Doctors hurt you, And it got so bad. It was, I was limping. I was in pain. And I went to the doctor. And finally, I told them. I went to the doctor. But he put some cream on it, some ointment. And the thing just, in half an hour, it felt better. But the point is, I was willing to go through a lot of suffering for nothing. But once you made that decision not to tell your parents, you knew it was stupid. Anyone with half a brain knew it was stupid to get yourself in this situation. And the more stupid it was, the less you wanted to change, the less you wanted to admit you were wrong. That's what passive investing is all about. The reason why people are so fanatical about it is it's so obviously wrong. It's not just wrong. It's painfully obvious that it's wrong. And all of us know it on some level of consciousness. None of us are so stupid that we can't understand that prices affect the result. And if prices affect the result, you obviously don't want to be at the same stock allocation at all price levels. You know, you don't need an IQ of 140 to figure that one out. So it's really hard to change people's views on something where they are obviously wrong. If you could come up with a, you know, a complicated reason why they're wrong, you can bring them around. But if it's too obvious, you've got a problem. And that's the situation we have with passive investing. It's obviously wrong. Now, I just want to read a little bit from this thread, because I think it relates to these issues at the Goon Central Board this morning. And this guy, let me see where this is. I had put up a post. Somebody had said, let me see what he's saying. He says, oh, Hoke goes one step further in terms of finance for and by enumerants. So he's saying, you know, this is, of course, idiotic goon talk. But I say, I don't put the numbers first. That much is fair to say. Common sense comes first. If you are coming up with numbers that are not in accord with what common sense tells you is possible, you need to check the methodology generating those numbers until you identify the analytical error. That's rational investing. It's the opposite of passive investing, which encourages people to stick with the same stock allocation when prices have gone to insanely dangerous levels of overvaluation. That makes no sense. It should not surprise any reasonable person that this approach has never worked in the real world. Now, I think, you know, the merit of that claim to me is so obvious that I can't even comment on it. It's just very basic. You know, that's not the reaction you get from passive investing dogmatist. Here's what one of the goons comes back with. There you have it, the anti-scientific method. Start with your conclusions. I didn't say I started with my conclusions. I said I started with common sense, which I think makes all the sense in the world. So here's my response to that one. There's no question but that I start with the belief that what my common sense tells me should be given a great deal of credence. I'm not dogmatic about it. If someone can present me with evidence that counterintuitive finding is reality, I'm fine with that. That's not the case here. Common sense tells me that valuations affect long-term returns. The historical data tells me the same thing. There's no conflict. This is the beauty of rational investing. I'm commenting now. The beauty of rational investing is that your common sense is no longer at war with your investing beliefs. And that gives you a confidence that passive investors can never come to possess. Back to the post. There is a big conflict for those on the other side. Both common sense and the historical data tells the passive investing dogmatist that their approach cannot work, yet they stick with it. That's science? No. The explanation of the conflict is that people made a mistake. There was academic research a good number of years back that showed that short-term timing doesn't work. Good and smart people jumped to a hasty conclusion that meant all forms of timing don't work. It's not so, and the evidence that it is not so is now a mountain. But the people who got it wrong are loath to admit that error, an error that has caused more human misery than any other error ever made in the history of personal finance. I care for the people who made this mistake. I respect the people who made this mistake. I consider the people who made this mistake my friends. I sure don't see it as an act of friendship to encourage them to continue repeating the irresponsible advice that they have been giving for 30 years now as a result of the mistake. The charitable thing to do is to point out the error while also pointing out the circumstances in which it was made. The charitable thing to do is to try to get to the other side, where all of these people can resume doing the good work that led to the earlier breakthroughs. The finding that short-term timing does not work was obviously a breakthrough insight. The people who advocate passive investing are better than they have shown themselves to be during the 3 decades in which they have ignored the growing mountain of evidence that they have made a mistake. Yes, I love these people. I also love the people who have been done great harm by their demonstrably poor investing advice. My job is to get them to see that there is no benefit to anyone for them to continue down the path they are on today. Skepticism is healthy and appropriate. Smear campaigns and willful ignorance and determined indifference to the realities, which are widely known to those familiar with the academic research of the past 30 years, help precisely no one. Love is constructive. Science is not ignorance. The idea that a mistake cannot be corrected when it is uncovered is not science. It is human weakness. It is a hateful thing. It is not an idea at all. It is a twisted and dark human emotion, something we should strive to overcome, not something that any of us should embrace. When we talk about cognitive dissonance, we're talking about an interesting phenomenon. It's counterintuitive. It can be demonstrated, you know, in test. When we talk about passive investing, we're talking about how this stuff plays out in the real world in an area of human endeavor that is of considerable importance. The passive investing era caused the massive overvaluation in the 1990s, which caused the massive price crash of the past 8-9 years. It's been a slow motion price crash that accelerated in the past 15 months. That price crash caused our economy to go into a recession. And if we don't figure out a way together to begin talking about these issues in a serious, mature, realistic way, there are serious people saying there's a risk of our economy going not into a recession, but a depression. Depressions can lead to all sorts of dark places. Depressions can lead to wars. So, you know, you can look at this phenomenon and you can laugh. You can say, oh, you know, people were waiting for a spaceship to come from outer space and it didn't come. They were waiting for the end of the world. And when the end of the world didn't come, they believed even more than before in the crazy idea. And that's sort of funny. You know, you could write a cartoon about it. But people losing their retirement money or people's businesses failing is not so funny. And, you know, as I say in that post that I read, the idea on the table isn't, oh, all the passive investors must, you know, abandon everything they believe. What I'm trying to do is to get a debate, a national debate started on what really works in stock investing. And the way it should work is that there are many people who sincerely believe in passive investing. They should certainly say that. But there are many people who don't. There are many people who have doubts. And those people should also state their sincere views. And collectively, we should work it out as a community. What we need in investing today is less arrogance, less pomposity, less certitude, and more humility. And there's a fellow who wrote a book once on investing that I read, who argued that humility is an important investing virtue. That fellow's name is John Holmes. Good luck with your investing strategies.